Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode is brought to you by the University of California Press, publishers of Wilted, Pathogens, Chemicals, and the Fragile Future of the Strawberry Industry by Julie Guthman. Learn more at ucpress.edu. This week on Meat and Three, we are examining the true cost of convenience when it comes to when, where, and how we eat.
Dark stores enable workers to eat without any kind of thought to how they're getting their food or how it might have come to be.
DoorDash, Uber, and Lyft in the past have pledged to spend $90 million to try to exempt themselves from the law.
I could be wrong, but I think there's going to be significant regulatory pushback on driverless trucks.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today we're going to be talking beef cattle to be precise. And my guest is Leah Biondo, the Director of Policy and Outreach for the United States Cattlemen's Association. Leah manages the day-to-day operations for the Western Skies Strategies in Washington, D.C., with clients like the United States Cattlemen's Association. The team at WSS helps associations and individuals successfully navigate Capitol Hill. She has also been a contributor to pieces that have been spotlighted by CNBC, The Washington Post, the BBC, RFD-TV, and the National Institute for Lobbying and Ethics. Welcome to the program, Leah. Thank you so much for joining me today, especially at short notice. I appreciate that.
No, thank you so much for having us here today. I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, there is a lot to unpack here, but let's start just by talking about what the United States Cattlemen's Association is and what you do.
Sure. So the U.S. Cattlemen's Association, or USCA, you might hear me say throughout this program today, we are a nationwide organization of cow-calf producers, feedlot operators, backgrounders, and livestock haulers. We've got coast-to-coast membership, you know, all four corners of the United States, and we really are, you know, driven by the producer for the producer.
Mm-hmm. And so you have a very wide membership, in other words. That's a lot of people to take in.
Absolutely.
Now, and just in case people are familiar enough, and I'm not guaranteeing that my listeners are familiar enough, but they might be familiar enough to know that there is also such a thing as the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, which I've had a run-in or two myself with, and also the American Meat Institute and the RCAF Association. How do you differ from those two or three entities?
Sure. So the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, or NCBA, along with the Meat Institute, represent all segments of the industry. Well, I guess more so the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. But when these folks are trying to represent both the meat packers or the processors and the producers, there tends to be some differences in priorities, which I'm sure we'll get into more later. But we try to represent just those that producing segment because, again, both sides have very different priorities and need different things, frankly, when we're looking at the, you know, future of the industry.
Absolutely. So what would you say from your perspective, what are the most pressing? I just wanted people to understand that you represent the actual producers and you are not speaking on behalf of the processors and packers, who in this case are actually kind of an adversarial situation at the moment in the industry. But so what are the most pressing challenges that are facing those small and medium-sized cattle ranchers today? I'm not talking about the giant vertically integrated. I mean, not even, actually, it doesn't even work that way in cattle processing, does it, or cattle ranching? Almost all the people who raise cattle are generally tend to be on the smaller side. Wouldn't you say that?
I would say that that's about true, and we tend to use the word independent more so, because you're right, vertical integration has not yet reached our industry, and we're fighting hard to make sure that we don't become some of the other industries that we're seeing. But to answer your question, what are the most pressing challenges facing these cattle ranchers today? We're seeing across the country, cattlemen and women are, you know, looking at their bottom line and figuring out how they can stay in the black at the end of the year. Our concern, our organization concerns, you know, lies not only in the ability of our nation to continue producing the highest quality, safest food supply, but also in the ability of our producers to feed themselves. So our organization has identified 5 of the most pressing challenges that need to be addressed by Congress and the administration to move the needle positively for our farming and ranching families and give the industry a future. And those are securing truth and labeling on U.S. beef and alternative protein products, addressing needed marketing and competition reform, allowing for additional flexibility in the restrictive hours of service rules for independent livestock haulers. You got to forget, or you can't forget, the animal needs to make it from the farm to the processing plant, protecting the health of the domestic herd, and then modernizing the beef checkoff program.
Wow. Those are tall orders, each and every one of those. those are intense. Well, why don't we, let's start with your first, with the first pillar of your challenges there, which in my opinion is really consolidation in the market and the lack of transparency in pricing. How are you guys dealing with that? How are you addressing the consolidation of the market right now?
Sure. And for those of you who don't know, there are 4 main meatpacking companies that control a majority of the industry, of the processing side of the industry. And so for us, increasing that competition looks like giving smaller and medium-sized operations the ability to compete on a larger scale. And what I mean by that is right now in 23 states, we have state-inspected meat processing facilities, and those state-inspected meat processing facilities can only ship their meat product, within state lines. And so what we'd like to see and what we're hopeful to have, or what we're thankful, rather, to have champions in Congress for, is something called the New Markets for State-Inspected Meat and Poultry Act, and that was sponsored by Senator Mike Round from South Dakota and Senator Angus King from Maine. And what this bill would do would allow these state-inspected meat processing facilities to ship their product across state lines. So if you're looking, let's just say we are in Laramie, Wyoming, and we want to access that Denver, Colorado market, this bill would allow those processing facilities to do that, to ship across state lines. And what we think that will accomplish in the end is increasing competition in the packer segment, which would help address some of those consolidation concerns. Of course, nothing that we're going to be talking about today is the silver bullet. We are very much looking for minor fixes to a whole host of different issues that are going to help address some of these issues that we were talking about and some of these challenges that our ranchers are facing. But in terms of consolidation in the meat industry, we really need to be opening up opportunities for small and mid-sized packing facilities to compete.
So I'm kind of dim here. I listened to that with great interest. I was not aware of that, of those regulations, that there was that you even needed to have a new law that said that you could ship across state lines. Because isn't that what the big packers are doing already? I mean, aren't they shipping whatever they want, wherever they want it? I'm a little confused by that.
Sure. So the big four are regulated by federal meat inspection laws, and that allows them to ship internationally. State-inspected facilities aren't looking to ship, you know, to China. They're just looking to ship next door. So again, just allowing some flexibility in these rules. And of course, the federal and the state-inspected rules are exactly the same. They must meet that, comparability standard or whatever they call it in the regulation books. But I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. Thank you very much. I clearly wasn't paying close enough attention to realize that there was a difference between state and federal. And yes, that makes total sense to me now. And so what that would achieve, let's just be completely clear here, what that would achieve would be more competition in terms of the price point that would be paid to the producers if they were able to ship their product to another state where they might get a better price than they would, say, in a local packing house, which probably would be owned by one of those big four industrial players. Is that what we're saying here?
Yeah, with the caveat that our ranchers are producers of cattle. They're not producers of beef, so their product is cattle. And right now, the only options that they have are selling to the big four. So if we have these small to medium-sized facilities online and operating, they can shop around for prices, I guess, and see who's going to compete for their cattle, because our ranchers are producing some of the highest quality cattle that we've ever seen in this country, and so they're deserving of some of those pricing competition for sure.
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you for that. Okay, so your group supported something called the Interim Fair Farmer Practices Act, which was part of retooling of the Grain Inspection and Stockyards Act. Explain what those new regulations advocated for, because that has something to do with the pricing as well, right? Advocated for, and what has happened since the Trump administration has taken over.
Yes. The Fair Farmer Practices would have just clarified some definitions within the Packers and Stockyards Act that would have tipped the scales back in favor of the producer. And so to really understand what they were, we've got to go back to the history of the Packers and Stockyards Act. It was passed in 1921 to regulate sale of livestock by farmers. I know. It was passed following a long list of existing antitrust laws. So we're looking at the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, the Federal Trade Commission Act of 1914, the Clayton Act of 1914 again. And Congress recognized that, well, these existing laws, that list I just named off, addressed issues of anti-competitiveness in U.S. markets. They did not address the subject of individual producers interacting in the highly concentrated meatpacking sector. So there were no rules or regulations that protected the producers from this high concentration. So the Packers and Stockyards Act directly addressed this issue with its most critical portion of the law, which is Section 202. And Section 202 has been what you've been hearing most about. The purposes behind Section 202 were to be, the part of the act and the part of the law that protects producers from these meatpacking concentration and anti-competitive buying practices and all that other stuff. So Section 202 in October 2017, the USDA withdrew that interim final rule regarding the scope of Section 202 A and B of the Packers and Stockyards Act. Now, USDA is facing a lawsuit filing that withdrawal. And they were accused of violating Congress's mandate in the 2008 Farm Bill, which was to publish regulation that laid out criteria around contracting prices by June 2010. So we're a little bit behind the eight ball there from June 2010. But the organizations that sued USDA were making the accusations, stated that without a reasonable explanation for doing so, the agency's withdrawal of the rule was arbitrary and capricious. We've submitted a letter to Secretary Perdue that says, We urge the USDA's Grain Inspection, Packers and Stockyards Administration Division to carry out its mission of promoting fair and competitive trading practices for the overall benefit of consumers in American agriculture. So I know that was a lot of mumbo jumbo if you haven't been involved in these conversations before, but what we're really looking at here is that there is a specific organization or agency within USDA whose mission it is to promote fair and competitive trading practices, and we're just asking the administration to carry out that mission.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it was a long fought battle to get that far. I mean, it took the entire 8 years of the Obama administration, if I'm not mistaken, to even get that onto an agenda into Congress and have them vote on it. So I'm sure it's been desperately, really quite devastating to the community to have you know, the administration roll back any progress that was made on GPSA. So that's really... really discouraging. I can imagine you guys really took that on the chin. It's just an astonishing betrayal, really, of the community that voted this administration into office, as far as I can tell. I mean, wouldn't you say that it's kind of antithetical to what they promised when they campaigned?
Sure. We were advocating for these rules throughout the Obama administration and now the Trump administration. So we've always been in favor of just clarifying these definitions. Again, they're just definitions within the act that would give producers a little bit of power back in their corner and back in their corner of the negotiations.
Right. Let's talk for a minute about COOL, which is country of origin labeling. Which has also been a hot button issue. And COOL was passed again during the Obama administration. And then I think even before the end of the administration, it was rolled back because the World Trade Organization ruled in favor of Mexico and Canada, who claimed that COOL was unfair to them and that it would adversely affect their exports to the United States. Why is this such a hot button issue for American cattle producers?
I think first and foremost, country of origin labeling is such a hot button issue because there was a lot of contention surrounding its inception, surrounding its birth, rather. You have the producers, and this is where the differences between the organizations really matters, because you have the producers saying that, yes, we do have the right to differentiate our product within the marketplace. That label that we want to differentiate our product with should be born, raised, and harvested in the United States. And then you have the meatpacking segment of the industry saying it's very costly to separate out these animals and make sure that we've got everything, all of our ducks in a row, and make sure that there's a market for this product when it leaves our facility. So you're coming at it from two very different points of view, and a lot of money on the line, frankly, because if we were to still have that country of origin labeling in place, we would not be where we are currently with where the prices are in the cattle marketplace, because we saw in 2015, after COOL was repealed, that was December 2015, so just at the end of the Obama administration, we saw country of origin labeling repealed, and what happened was just a dramatic drop in cattle prices, and fairly immediately, too, and we haven't quite figured out how to get that market to swing back up yet, and we're sitting here 4 years later. So we're really looking at country of origin labeling not in terms of trying to, you know, get a mandatory country of origin labeling program back on the books, which would be great, of course, but we really right now just want to close the loophole that allows meat packers to put product of the USA on their products when they're not technically a product of the USA. So let me explain myself a little bit there. Right now, the way that the regulations currently stand, meat packers can import product into this country. So something like lean trim from South America, they can have that product undergo a significant transformation within our borders, which could be trimming the product, it could be repackaging the product, it could be blending it with domestic ground product. They then can use the definition or use the label product of the USA on that product and ship it off into American marketplaces. And that's perfectly legal the way it stands right now, because when we lost country of origin labeling in 2015, we also lost the definition for product of the USA. So right now that product of the USA definition is exactly how I described it. We know these companies are doing it, and we're actively pushing for a truthful labeling program, something that closes that loophole and defines product of the USA to be something that's born, raised, and harvested in the USA.
Right. And when you say, I'm going to back you up for a second, you said one of the reasons that the industry pushed back against Cool was because they said it would be too expensive for them to segregate the domestic product from imported product, which they now feel, you know, no compunction about blending into, say, ground beef, or even just repackaging for sale here with a USDA stamp on it. You know, I've been to a packing plant. I just want to clarify something. Like, there, every time a packer, you know, gets a herd of cattle into that plant, that all of that cattle is identified by its tags or whatever. So I have to say, like, that is the most specious bit of reasoning I've ever heard, that they can't keep them separate. They have to keep them separate so they can pay each producer. Isn't that right? I mean, they already have to keep every single line of cattle separate from others. So why would this provide this unbearable burden to them? I'm unclear about that. How do they explain that?
I would absolutely agree with you. And as the industry is moving towards greater transparency, traceability, whether our trading partners are demanding it or whether consumers are demanding it, we're going to have to keep more paperwork in line, frankly. When we're looking towards the future and we're looking at things like blockchain, which our organization has not taken a stance on yet, but we are looking into the issue and we've assigned a committee to do so. But when we're looking at, you know, these kind of futuristic traceability systems in the food industry, this is one of the things that the meat packers are going to have to get better at.
Yeah, no kidding. Absolutely. I mean, now all of a sudden I saw today, I mean, this is why I need an outline, Leah, because otherwise I'm never going to stay on the topic. But you saw, I know, that pork producers, if they want to sell to China, they have to reduce or eliminate their use of ractopamine, which I've done a number of shows about in the past. And so, you know, here's another example of where, you know, if you want to sell into another market, say the Chinese market, you or the European market, you have to segregate those pigs out. So, I mean, it is just a completely specious, I'm just reiterating my point, that it's a completely specious idea. Can you explain real quick, though? I don't want to take up too much time on it, but I read about blockchain. I thought it was really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about what that technology would be and how is that different from Cool?
Sure. So we're still trying to figure that out ourselves. And from what we've understood, blockchain, you know, would allow producers to trace their cattle from birth until it ends up in the grocery store. And one of the neatest examples I think I've seen of this is if you look at this bottle of wine, I think it's called 19 Wine Company or 19, I should have been better prepped for that. But there's this wine company out there where if you point your phone at the bottle, it actually kind of comes to life and tells its story. We'd love to be able to do something like that with beef. And I think blockchain could definitely fit into that equation. But again, we haven't taken official stance on blockchain. We're still kind of working out, you know, cattle traceability issues and what's the best way to trace your cattle, whether it's an ear tag, whether it's an RFID tag. You know, we've been implementing, we've had brands, we've had tattoos, we've had all of these things. But what's that next step in the industry for greater transparency and traceability? Those are the things we're still working through. And are definitely looking forward to coming out and figuring out how we can make it part of the future of the industry.
Right. I thought blockchain sounded great only because once you have that chunk of data, it can't be uncoupled from before or after. I mean, it really does guarantee transparency. And I know I'm being vague there, but I don't totally understand the technology myself. But I did think it seemed like a really, a very effective means of guaranteeing transparency in a supply chain, especially one that is as typically murky as that of cattle is in this market. We're going to take a quick break, Leah, for a sponsor drop. Stay tuned, folks.
This episode is brought to you by the University of California Press, publishers of Wilted by Julie Guthman. Strawberries are big business in California. They are the sixth highest grossing crop in the state, yet the industry is often criticized for its backbreaking labor conditions and dependence on highly toxic soil fumigants used to control fungal pathogens and other soil-borne pests. In her new book, Wilted, Julie Guthman tells the story of how the strawberry industry came to rely on soil fumigants and how that reliance reverberated throughout the rest of the fruit's production system. The particular conditions of plants, soils, chemicals, climate, and laboring bodies that once made strawberry production so lucrative in the Golden State have now jeopardized the future of the industry. Learn why it's so difficult to stop using these chemicals in strawberry production, and why the strawberries you find in the grocery store today are different from what your grandparents may have savored. Pick up Wilted, Pathogens, Chemicals, and the Fragile Future of the Strawberry Industry by Julie Guthman, available now wherever books are sold.
We are back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. My name is Katie Kiefer. I'm speaking with Leah Biondo today of the United States Cattlemen's Association. And we are talking about sort of the difficulties of being a cattle rancher in today's market, some of the major challenges that face cattle producers around the United States. Leah, let's talk for a second about the truth in labeling, because you guys are spending a lot of effort on getting truth in labeling, which from the point of view of country of origin labeling, I totally get. But the truth in labeling legislation that you're pushing for is to make sure that people know that the Impossible Burger or Beyond Burger or any other meat substitute is a substitute and is not actually meat. And I'm here to say that I think most consumers are going to get that without necessarily needing legislation. So why is that so important to your industry?
Sure. And when we're talking about truth in labeling, you know, we've seen these Boca burgers. We've seen the veggie burgers. They've been around since before the 80s. You know, they've been in grocery stores. Consumers are familiar with them. But what we are concerned with is the development of cell-cultured foods, specifically cell-cultured foods that are replicating muscle tissue, fat tissue, connective ligaments, things where these companies are attempting to recreate meat or beef in the laboratory. And from our point of view, those petri dish proteins are not meat, they're not beef, and they need to be labeled as such. So a lot of our efforts are focused in the cell cultured protein space. And we were pleased to see earlier this year that USDA and FDA joined forces, joined hands, and agreed to joint regulate those products, which we think is the absolute best possible outcome for cell cultured foods. You've got the expertise and knowledge at FDA on the laboratory and pre-manufacturing side of things. And then you've got the expertise at USDA, where they are in meat processing plants and facilities across the country, and they understand what it takes to get that from product to marketplace. And so we're really looking at truth in labeling in terms of protecting or, you know, redefining what it means to be beef or meat.
Thanks. That makes a lot of sense. I understand that. I still think consumers are going to know the difference. I think that they're going to be looking for something that isn't an actual animal in its origin, if that is their bent, if you know what I mean. Like, if you feel like you can still consume animal protein, you just don't want it to be an animal that actually lived and died. You know, I'm going to reserve judgment on that whole sort of moral and ethical rationalization. I guess it's okay. I don't know. I haven't really thought it through completely, but it seems kind of, I don't know what it seems. It seems kind of crazy. Let's move on, though. Let's talk about the impact of the trade wars on your constituency. What is happening with, I know obviously it's given the pork industry quite a shot in the arm because the Chinese, I mean, those tariffs have been relaxed now and the Chinese are importing a lot of pork because of the African swine flu. But what has been the impact on the cattle industry?
Oof, yes, the ongoing trade disputes. Well, cattle and beef are perishable products, which means they've got limited and time-sensitive marketing periods, which makes them face more unique challenges than some of the other ag products, trying to think, produce maybe. And of course, cattle and beef are something where we've got it takes a long time to bring them to market. It takes almost, you know, just as long to you know, birth a new cattle or beef. So I guess what I'm saying is, yes, they're unique, they're perishable products, and we're seeing in the ongoing trade disputes some interesting things happening. You know, exports are critical to our industry. We're pleased to see progress on that free trade agreement with Japan. Japan's one of our biggest markets. They're followed up by South Korea and Mexico, actually. So we're pleased to see that free trade agreement with Japan. We're pleased to see ongoing trade discussions with South Korea and the USMCA deal continuing to move along. But we are seeing an overall 3% decline in pounds of beef exported this year. So in 2018, the U.S. exported about $8.3 billion worth of U.S. beef. So a 3% decline on that is nothing to scoff at. And we really need certainty in our markets right now, and our trade partners need certainty in their trade agreements, really. And that's kind of, you know, the end of the line there.
It is the end of the line because, I mean, as you point out, I mean, I'll just reiterate for listeners, like it takes the gestation period for a cow to give birth, and then it takes at least 11 months for that cow to get to market weight. So you're talking about almost a 2-year cycle. So for cattlemen who are trying to predict what's going to happen next year, let alone, you know, years following, this creates an almost untenable position for them, does it not? Coupled with, I mean, I suppose grain price fluctuations are another major, although grain prices are so low right now because of the surpluses, but that's another factor that has a big impact on cattle ranching. Yeah, I don't know how people are managing that. We just have to make more Americans eat more beef, I guess, right?
You hit the nail on the head, though. You know, our producers are managing risk. They're managing their operations for several years out. So this idea that they need certainty in their markets is a real one, and they can feel it back home when they're making those decisions each spring and fall.
Absolutely. So what would be your response to the, I'm just going to go a little generalized here now, because I just wondered what you thought. I've done a couple of shows around the class action suits that are being brought against the poultry industry, both by consumers and by, both by farmers and by grocery store chains. You've been following this, I'm sure, Leah, but you know that they've been claiming that the prices have been fixed, wages have been frozen sort of illegally. I wondered if you see anything sort of similar to that happening in the cattle market.
No, absolutely. This is an issue in the cattle industry too, and maybe not for the same reasons as in the poultry industry, but utilizing the same mechanisms and talking about the same things on the cattle side. As we mentioned earlier in this show, Section 202 of the Packers and Stockyards Act was meant to address these concerns of anti-competitive buying practice and collusive behaviors. Unfortunately, now the Section 202, most of it's been overturned and misinterpreted and misunderstood for so long that we really are getting away from the original intent of the act. And so when we look at that phrase included within the act, the harm to competition phrase, which is what is the controversy surrounding the poultry industry, too, they're looking at this harm to competition phrase. The interpretation of this phrase has kind of led to preferential contract deals. We're looking that have you know, increased captive supply by the packers and decimated the price discovery in the marketplace. This unreasonable requirement we're also seeing within Section 202 is, you know, allowing packers to continue paying premiums for higher quality and value-based pricing without the threat of litigation. So we're seeing both sides of the coin here. You know, addressing these definitions within the Packers and Stockyards Act is simply going to put a more level playing field in play for both the producers and the meat packers. So, again, we're just trying to clarify those definitions within the Packers and Stockyards Act, and that's going to address a lot of these issues that we're seeing surrounding the poultry industry and a lot of the issues we have within the cattle industry as well.
Why do you think the USDA rolled that Section 202 back? What was the rationale behind sort of decimating that forward thinking, leveling the playing field kind of legislation? What reason did they offer you for that?
Sure. So we were hearing pushback from kind of the meat packing sector that, you know, rolling back these protections would allow for increased litigation. So in terms, if we're looking at this harm to competition phrase, if you roll it back to where the producer only has to show harm to themselves in a price fixing or a price fixing scandal, however you want to call it, price fixing problem, they were saying that it would open up litigation and we would have all of these onslaughts of class act lawsuits, and we would just see chaos in the meatpacking industry. And what would really happen instead is not putting the burden on the producer to show harm to an entire industry when they were wronged. So just repeating myself again here, if we're looking at the harm to competition phrase and a producer right now has to show that harm was done to them and the entire industry, whereas we would rather see that harm to competition phrase be clarified to its original intent and purpose, which is that there was harm to the producer and not having to put the burden on them to show that there was harm to an entire industry, which is nearly impossible to do. So clarifying those definitions, getting them back to the original intent would put us more in line with what Congress wanted in 1921 to make a more level playing field for producers in the meatpacking industry.
Thanks. I just wanted to hammer that point home, that because I just found it so outrageous. Like, it was such a giveaway to the industry, just like the caving on country of origin labeling was another big giveaway to the industry. I'm not a fan of the industry, I guess you can tell. I think meat is great. Don't get me wrong. I'm a big meat, you know, I like it. I eat it. I like it. I promote it. But I think that the way the industry has evolved over the last 60, 70 years is a large part of why rural economies are flailing, if not sinking altogether right now. So that's kind of, that's why I like to get these points, like hammer those points home again and again, just because it's complicated stuff. And if you're not familiar with it, you know, it really, the more it gets explained, the more people see, you know, their eyes are open to like, oh, that's what's going on here. Well, I wanted to ask you one more. This is kind of a throwaway question, but, you know, last week, Sonny Perdue, when, you know, it some sort of rally or event that he attended, basically gave a rephrase of Earl Butz's famous remark, get big or get out. How did your constituency respond to that? I can't imagine that went over very well in the farming community. What do you think?
Well, I will say we were disappointed in that statement. I think, and I hope what Secretary Perdue was trying to get out there was saying, you know, producers need to innovate. They need to, you know, make themselves stand out in the marketplace. They need to give themselves value in the marketplace, because the get big or get out philosophy is disappointing when you're looking at, you know, all of our small to medium-sized ranching and family farming operations in this country. I will say that I don't think you do have to get big or get out. I think there's a place for producers in the marketplace who are growing a product that is going to go either into a niche marketplace or, you know, even putting it into the regular industry supply of beef or meat. They're still important. And I hope our producers really took that away from the secretary's talk last week and didn't necessarily take away that, you know, all of us should be giant, you know, corporate feed yards and feedlots. And while there's nothing, you know, inherently wrong with that, there isn't anything inherently wrong with being a small to medium sized producer either. There's a place for everybody in the industry. And again, I really hope that the secretary meant more of distinguishing yourself or differentiating yourself in the marketplace. But the organization really, in terms of how we're going to react to that statement, it's just by doing what we've always done, we're always working towards strengthening the bottom line for the independent cattle producer. And that strategy hasn't changed since our inception. Every policy we create, every piece of legislation that we lobby for, everything is driven for the producer by the producer. Our leadership themselves are working cattlemen and women. They understand the issues every day because they live them. They're the ones submitting a Schedule F each year instead of a W-2, so they understand and they know that their livelihoods are on the line, which is why you did see so much vitriol last week towards the secretary's statement.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we didn't get a chance to talk about the hauling. So I'm not going to go there now because we've actually kind of gotten past our time period here and I don't want to take up too much of your time. But just to close, what do you think consumers need to know the most about the cattle industry? Where do you think there is a disconnect between consumers and your industry?
Love this question because I see it every day when I'm reading through the news. And I want to answer it with something that I found curious earlier this year. I was reading through the New York Times. They had published this beautiful piece that was covering the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering in Elko, Nevada. The article itself was titled Work Songs of the Cowboy Poets. The author had blended the language that he was seeing with the cowboys and turned it into 10 short videos. But almost the very next day in the same publication, there was another article titled No One Is Taking Your Hamburger, But It Would It Even Be a Good Idea? And the title caught my eye because I thought that the piece might be taking on that narrative that we see so often nowadays that cattle are somehow inherently bad for the environment. But I kept reading and she led into the article with, you know, quote unquote, cutting back on burgers can help your own health and the planet. And one of the things that I took away from that is while Americans consistently seem to romanticize the big skies, the endless horizons, the cowboy lifestyle, there seems to be kind of a common misunderstanding of the exact role that cattle play in the carbon cycle. And our members maintain those wide open spaces throughout the West, throughout the East Coast, throughout the Southeast, the Southwest, through the use of grazing animals. And when properly managed, and that means controlling the timing, duration, and intensity of grazing, those cattle play a vital role in restoring native prairie species and keeping out the invasives and other undesirable plant species. So what I guess I would hope that consumers take away from this and what consumers need to know about the cattle industry is that the cattle industry and agriculture on a whole is a cycle, and livestock can, you know, restore native prairie grasses, but they can also eat waste products like dried distiller grains from breweries and turn that into a high quality nutrient dense protein. And so producers nowadays are producing more tons of beef with fewer animals on fewer acres of land than ever before. And, you know, cattle not only fit into this, but they also complement the carbon cycle. So, again, thank you for that question, because it's very important that I think there is a seeming disconnect between consumers and the products that they're consuming. And this is one of those examples that I think, you know, folks should really, really hone in on.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm glad that you gave that answer. It was an excellent answer. I think that people conflate animal agriculture with CAFOs and think that that's the only way that animals are raised in this country, and that's not true. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of environmental issues associated with concentrated area feeding operations. And I think that's a model that needs to go away or be altered in some significant way. But the reality is that the land needs grazing animals, that it's always had grazing animals, and that grazing animals are actually great for the environment. So thank you very much for that. I'm going to just wrap up by saying, tell people where they can learn more about your organization or follow the news on what's happening in the cattle industry. What would be your favorite news source for that?
Absolutely. Well, jump onto our social media feed. You can find us at U.S. Cattlemen on Twitter. You can find us United States Cattlemen's Association on Facebook. We're constantly sharing industry news, but most importantly, go on your Twitter feed right now and go find hashtag Fair Cattle Markets. You'll see almost an entire uprising of cattle producers across the country. The past 2 weeks, they've been participating in kind of this grassroots advocacy, and you can really learn more and engage with producers through the power of social media.
Fantastic. Leah, thank you so, so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. And I'll definitely keep you in my database because you sure are a great spokesman for your organization. I really appreciate your time. Thanks a lot. And thanks to my sponsor today and to my engineer. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening, folks. Have a good one. So long for now. What Doesn't Kill You is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.